Good afternoon, everybody. What I want to talk about today are some aspects of the Chinese space program, but in particular, how they got to where they are right now, what their capabilities are, and in particular, how Australia could learn something from this. Because I've been fairly actively involved in China now for, it's just on 10 years now, it suddenly occurred to me. The Chinese have done a lot of things right that we could learn from as we attempt to establish an Australian space program in this country, as it says somewhere else in the beginning. Like most space programs, in fact, I hate to generalise, but I think all around the world at the moment, the Chinese space program grew out of the military environment just after the Second World War. At that stage, the Chinese and the Russians were quite friendly. One of the few people that the Russians actually were quite friendly with. And there was a lot of technical transfer between the two countries in the 50s and into the early 60s. You still see signs of that transfer, technical transfer in China today in the space industry. You go into factories, talk to the senior executives, management and so on. I'd say a good 30 to 40% of them got their technical training in Russia in the 50s and 60s. So there are still signs of that. And there's a good 30 or 40% of them who got their technical training in the States. There's been a lot of cross-fertilisation of people and technologies and thought processes. The liaison with the Soviet Union and China was basically broken when they got in a bit of a tiff over supporting the transfer of nuclear technology to China in 1959. And from that point on, the two sides basically went their own way. At that stage, the Soviets had already helped the Chinese establish production facilities for this little baby. It looks very familiar, doesn't it? In fact, there's one down here in front of me I noticed. It looks like a V2, doesn't it? Well, actually, it's a Chinese copy of the Russian copy of the V2. The Russian copy of the V2 is called the SS-2 Sibling, or in the civilian version, it was called the Pobeda. But the Chinese had production facilities for this vehicle going in a factory in southern Beijing, in a town called Wanyuan, since about 1958. But really the purpose in that was to establish an industrial capability. It itself was not a particularly useful vehicle for China. Too short range, its enemies are much further over the hill than that's capable of getting to. But it was an excellent manufacturing, technology, training tool. Having learned how to build Chinese copy of Russian copies of the V2, they then turned their hands to something that was far more useful to them. And this was the entirely indigenously produced Chinese CSS-1, it's known as in the West, standing for Chinese surface-to-surface missile. In China, it's called the Dongfeng 2. Dongfeng meaning east wind, for those of you who are interested in such trivia. The good thing about the CSS-1 is that it still holds the record as the only carrier of a live nuclear warhead on a rocket which has been exploded is on the ground. There have been warheads carried into space on at least two occasions and fired there, but this was a live simulation of an attack on a city, and it's the only time it's ever been done in either the East or the West. And that happened on October 27, 1966, a long time ago. But again, it had its constraints as a missile because, as you can see by the white halfway up it, that's not paint, that's ice. And that's a giveaway. One of the propellants is oxygen. Liquid oxygen. You can't store the stuff. So it's not very good as a quick reaction missile for any practical purposes. But again, it gave the Chinese wonderful technical background, production expertise, cryogenic handling capabilities. They learned how to do that. Very, very good training vehicle. The first time that the Chinese really attempted to get it right was in this animal called the CSS-2. The propellants in this are all storable, so it can be set up and fired at minute's notice. It can be stored fully fueled, no problem. It's a missile whose diameter is 2.25 metres, and that I will come back to later on. A very important number. And this is equally as important. It became an export commodity to the Chinese. So they learnt how to internationally market their aerospace technology. In fact, the largest single customer for the CSS-2 has been Saudi Arabia. who has a standing fleet of estimates varied, but up to 50 of these. And during the Gulf War, that was one of the triumphs of Western diplomacy that got virtually no publicity at all, that the Saudis were constrained from using their Chinese CSS-2s against you-know-who. However, all of these vehicles so far really are very constrained in their range. You can get better by adding a second stage to the existing CSS-2, and that becomes, wait for it, the CSS-3. Improved range, many of these built in China, many of them deployed around the country. In fact, if you go to a military museum in China, in Beijing, just off Tiananmen Square, there's one out there in the front courtyard on show. The good thing about the CSS-3 is in its civilian guise, it became the Long March 1, the first of the family that is still expanding and still being developed, that I'll spend a fair fraction of the rest of this talk covering. Currently, the Long March 1, which is essentially that, is available commercially to launch small satellites, and by small I mean typically about anything up to 800 odd kilos into a polar orbit. But as far as the Chinese are concerned, the significance of this vehicle was on the 24th of April 1970, it was used to launch China's first satellite. A very simple satellite, a bit like Sputnik 1, just a sphere, about the same size too, about 60 centimetres diameter. Very straightforward, but at least they got themselves into space. Start to see something that you'll notice from here on in this talk, that there is two paths developing. The Chinese clearly, and at the time of the DFH-1 satellite, had for about 20 years a structure in place to develop launch vehicles. Now you see a structure coming in to develop satellite technologies, fully acknowledging the idea that, and the concept that, well, let's face it, the aim of all this is to get satellites up there. It's not to build rockets. From here on, you'll notice an increasing standardisation in the Chinese launch vehicle capability. Whereas, from here on, you'll see them experimenting in all different types of satellite technologies. This is a very simple, unstabilised sphere. You'll see coming on spin-stabilised satellites, three-axis stabilised satellites, all sorts of other things. There was an interesting trend starting at that point. But they still had a long way to go in developing their launch vehicle technology. And again, driven by the military agendas, they spent the latter half of the 1960s and the early half of the 1970s developing what was going to be the first of the standard building blocks of their launch vehicle program. And here's a picture of one of the early Long March 2s, or LM2s, taking off. It's probably the first time in history that the civilian version of a rocket has been developed in parallel with the military version, because that version of the LM2, known as the CSS-4, is a very, very capable ICBM with a range of some 15,000 kilometres. But in the civilian form, it's the LM2. The first of these flew in 1970-odd or thereabouts, has been an enormously successful vehicle in its own right. So far, the current version of the LM2, called the LM2C or D, has launched 17 satellites successfully. On average, they would launch about one or two of these a year at the moment. One of the early satellites was this little animal. It isn't a sphere anymore. It's got some asymmetries in it, which implies it needs a guidance system or an attitude control system. New technology developed, and this was only 3 years after that previous satellite I told you about. This is called Practice 2B, and the Chinese aren't afraid to simply say that we're just trying something here and see if it works. They even call their satellite Practice. Solar panels, deployable solar panels. You can get a further technology that they hadn't attempted previously. But the real triumph so far of the Chinese satellite program is this. a very unassuming object called the FSW-1 capsule. There's at least 15 of these have flown so far, and not surprisingly, what it basically is the nose cone of the Long March 2, which is exactly what it looks like. It can carry a very useful payload of 150-odd kilograms into space, and here's the good bit. See the dark nose cone there? That is actually a re-entry shield. And some 12 of these capsules have been successfully recovered. In fact, up until a rather unfortunate overshoot a year and a half ago, the Chinese had 100% success rate in recovering capsules from orbit. But again, in an absolutely typically pragmatic Chinese way of doing things, they didn't go for fancy phenolic heat shield technology, they didn't do anything fancy. Their ablative heat shield is oak timber, and it works fine. Very simple, very cheap, very light, and it works fine. So again, that's a very typical Chinese way of doing things that I think many of us could take heed of. Well, at about this time, the Chinese thought, well, we better get serious about higher orbit satellites, geosynchronous orbit satellites, for example. But the LM-2 can't do it. It doesn't have the grunt. How about if we put a third stage on top of the LM-2, which is in itself a two-stage vehicle? So they designed a thing called the LM-4. The LM-4 is the LM-2 with a third stage, similar propellants as the first two stages, and those of you who know something about rockets will immediately be wary of that combination, because an efficiently designed rocket very rarely can get away with having the same propellants in all its stages. And so it turned out to be. But the LM-4 is an excellent vehicle, but it simply doesn't have the grunt to take a decent-sized satellite into synchronous orbit or anywhere close to it. So the LM-4, although designed as a communication satellite launcher, eventually found its role in life sometime after it was essentially shelved for almost 10 years to launch the new generation of Chinese low-Earth orbit Earth observation satellites, the Fenyang-1. There has been several agencies in Australia have been receiving weather information and other Earth observation data from that satellite. But again, it's bigger than the other two I've shown you. It's got far more sophisticated solar arrays. See that silver paper on the outside? That implies that they're having to come to grips with thermal control subsystems, which are a big issue on satellites. So again, this is a quantum step up in Chinese satellite design and implies that they've had to learn a whole new set of skills again. When the Long March 4 didn't prove big enough to orbit a Chinese domestic communications satellite, the Chinese then set about modifying, in fact designing, an entirely new third stage to be put on top of the Long March 2. This evolved into the Long March 3. And probably the greatest single triumph of the Chinese space program so far. Why? Because that third stage uses cryogenic fuels, hydrogen and oxygen. At the time, China was only the second country in the world, after the US, to successfully fly a cryogenically fueled rocket. Cryogenics are nasty things to handle because of the very cold temperatures of the propellants. The engineering that you need is several steps up on conventional propellants, and the fact that the Long March 3 family has been so successful, I don't have the figures here in front of me, but it's something like 9 launches so far. The first one failed, but only just. You would call it a partial success, I guess, and they had a significant failure at about number 7. But apart from that, it's been a very, very successful vehicle for them. To give you some idea as to the complexity of the beast, here's the business end of the Long March 3 third stage. It's an extraordinarily complex engine. They have a common set of turbo pumps feeding 4 combustion chambers, if you can picture that. I like this slide because it shows something else very typical of the Chinese space program. You go to one of their rocket factories or satellite factories, compare it to one in the West. If you go to one, say, Hughes Aircraft or whoever, and you see men rushing around in white coats with huge volumes of technical drawings and, you know, data and test plans and all this sort of stuff, look there. There's not a sheet of paper in sight. I get the impression that the entire vehicle is assembled by people who have all the technical information simply in their heads. I don't think I've ever seen what I would call a good process manual in any Chinese factory, but they seem to be capable of assembling these things anyhow, or in spite of that. I don't know how they do it. Again, it's just a difference in culture that we would find hard ourselves, I guess. Another difference in culture, and those of you who have ever been involved in anything associated with satellites are aware of how fanatical we are about cleanliness. You know, you don't touch a satellite without anti-static suits on and all this funny stuff. Well, look at how the Chinese encapsulate their satellite on top of the rocket out there in the breeze. There's no enclosure around it. I guess they're smart enough not to attempt it on a rainy day. When I first saw that photo, I almost fell over backwards. By our standards, it's incredible. But again, it's very typically Chinese. If you really don't need something, don't bother doing it. Very pragmatic people. Another leap in technology. But see, up till now, their other complex satellite was FY1. I talked about earlier on that square box all covered in silver paper. That's one way of doing it. Another way is to have a circular drum-shaped satellite like that. It's a different set of technologies. It's a different set of skills they have to master. But again, they're trying it. They've done it. So now they can say they've had experience of those two different basic concepts in satellite technology. The next big leap, again, was in launch vehicle technology. But again, in a very, very typically pragmatic way. When it became clear that China had the ability to market their launch services in the West, they needed a really large, say, Ariane-class rocket to do it with. And the first example they came up with was the Long March 2E. And this is the one that we used, or have used on three occasions over the last 3 years for our satellites. It's a big brute, 52 metres high. The core stage is a stretched Long March 2C first and second stage. 3.3 metres diameter is that core stage. But it's got four liquid propellant strap-ons there, 2.25 metres diameter. Basically, those strap-ons are Long March 1, you know, back in the 70s, first stages, with a core engine attached to it. The Long March 2E is now the new basis for all large Chinese commercially orientated satellite launching vehicles. And I will talk about a couple of variations on that shortly. But that's the one that we used. How everything fits together is inside the fairing, the OSSAT satellite, OSSAT slash Optus, all the same, one big happy family now. The interesting bit is that thing beneath it. There's a big solid motor sticking there, which is used to boost the perigee of the transfer orbit higher. So that's called the perigee kick motor. For our launches, we had to provide our own perigee kick motor. And this is a big motor. It's filled and set to go. It weighs just under 5 tonnes. It's a fairly sizable beast. It's called the Star 63 because its diameter is 63 inches or over 5 feet. We bought our own PKMs. The next Western commercial satellite to go on the LM2 will be using a Chinese-built perigee kick motor. So in the meantime, the Chinese have been developing the skills to build very large, very reliable commercial solid motors as well. So you have a wide range of skills in satellite technology, a family of rockets that's hugely flexible. Really, all the elements that you need for an integrated, commercially orientated, surprisingly, space program. Traditionally, fairings have been a weak point of most launch vehicle designs. In the early days of Atlas, they tended to come apart with monotonous frequency. The aerodynamic loads on fairings are huge, so they have to be designed and built extremely carefully. This is by far the largest honeycomb composite structure China has ever attempted. It's probably around 8 metres from bottom to top, and it's around 5 metres diameter. It's a huge structure by itself. As some joker put it, about five Chinese families could easily occupy each half. Okay, well, as I've already said to you, the LM2E was used successfully in our case in August 92 and August 94 to launch two of our satellites, not quite so successfully in December 92, and I'm sure you're all up to speed on what happened there. I don't have time to go into it now, but the quick answer to the inevitable question is no, we still don't know what went wrong. But based on the Long March 2 core, take the strap-ons off, the Chinese have developed a successive vehicle, and this is where their future lies, which has flown twice, the first time early last year and the second time late last year, flying a Chinese-built three-axis stabilised, 24-channel, C-band, tightly professionally built communication satellite, the Long March 3A. Take the core of the 2E, build an entirely new cryogenic third stage, hydrogen-oxygen fuels. Again, very difficult. Two brand new Chinese-developed engines there. And you can probably think of the capability of that vehicle if you start putting strap-ons on it again. So at the moment, the Long March family of launch vehicles is starting to get standardised. But the intriguing thing about it is, from the Long March 1, which all of these vehicles are currently in production and you can order them. The last Long March 1 was built at about the same time as the last Saturn V. You try getting the Yanks to build a Saturn V for you these days. The Chinese will do you an LM1 in about 6 months. They have kept all the tooling, they've kept all the engineering, they've kept everything. They can build one for you. But the other interesting thing about this entire family is that one of the best ways of standardising and getting economies in launch vehicles is to keep the same diameters and just extend them longer and longer if you need extra capability. And that is a lesson for the Australian industry if we ever enter this type of market. From the LM1 onwards, there is only two diameters in every vehicle there of the tanks. And the tanks are the expensive bit and the hard-to-make bits. There is only, therefore, two sets of tooling needed. In fact, only two sets of tooling exist in China, and I've seen them, in one factory. And they can build virtually all the structures of every one of those vehicles there. Now, I ask you to compare again. The only other country who has tried to standardise launch vehicle options are our French friends at Arianespace. The Ariane 4, you have a wide selection of strap-ons for the first stage that can be tailored to your particular payload. And that's why Ariane's capturing nearly 60% of the commercial market now, because by standardising they keep their overheads down. And that is a vital lesson for Australia to learn if we ever get serious about our own space industry. The Chinese have established a vast network of launch sites optimised for particular missions, and that's a lesson we have to learn in Australia. We hear about Darwin, we hear about Cape York, we hear about Woomera. The simple geography of Australia means that we can, I would suggest, never get by with just one launch site. We need a whole range of them. Now, I'm a particular proponent of the Cape York site, and you know, I spent quite some time examining that proposal, and I still believe it's the only viable equatorial site in this country. But there are others. Going into polar orbit, I think given the sensitivity of some of our Asian neighbours, we don't want to go north, we have to go south. So we're talking of a site somewhere along the south coast of Australia. There are many of them, many fine sites. So again, diversity is going to be an essential part of any Australian launch complex. There will be several of them, not just one. This is the northern Chinese site, Zhejiang, in the Gobi Desert. This is where the first Chinese satellite flew from. Again, very complex infrastructure, which they do extremely well. They also have a very large infrastructure of tracking stations. The Chinese also build very good tracking hardware. They operate three fully instrumented tracking ships out in the South China Sea. And these obviously are a major capital investment. Oh, and at Sichuan itself, which is their prime commercial site, they have built enormously complex and expensive clean room facilities to keep fussy Western customers happy. The launch pad in Sichuan, again, built in typical Chinese fashion. A Western expert friend of mine toured that when it was being built, and he said it'll take them 3 years. It took them just over 12 months. When they want things to happen in China, they can happen extremely quickly, believe me. This brings me to the point that I'd like to finish on, that the Chinese do have a program in place for manned spaceflight. The last pronouncement was a month or two ago, in which they set a date using a Long March 2E rocket to put two men in space in a Gemini-class capsule by the end of the century. And having seen how the Chinese do things, I believe that they will get there extremely easily. So I would not be at all surprised to see Space Station Alpha being visited, or whatever it's called now, or this week, being visited by a Chinese capsule one day. In fact, one of the things that you learn about China is they publicise things in a very subtle way. If you read anything in the paper, there's always a hidden meaning to it, but there's always a strong element of truth in it. And I would not be at all surprised in the next couple of years to see an announcement to that effect. So that's where China is now. There's a lot that Australian industry can learn from how they've done it. It's a very well-coordinated program, very, very highly structured, and they do it extremely well. Well, I'm way over time, but thank you for your interest, and I hope that's been of interest for you today.